We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
You are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Kim, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you?
Hey, Kim. Good afternoon. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good afternoon to you. Well, are you ready to talk about Season 6, Episode 17 of Unsolved Mysteries?
Yeah, this was a sleeper of an episode in my eyes. Like, I was like, oh, okay, this what? And then it really comes to life.
Yeah, this is definitely a cult classic. When you ask people what they remember about Unsolved Mysteries, you're going to get the whistleblown episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you said this one really is one that comes up very, very often and is discussed by everyone. I mean, there are a lot of visuals here, of course, and a lot of things that are disturbing that they talk about, but I would say that we are so far this will be the second one that's a really highly discussed episode that we're covering. The Tammy Lynn episode is one of those ones where if you just kind of search for it, it kind of pops up, and it just seems like it has really captured the imagination of a lot of people. They're not happy with the official outcome, and people are just digging, and they really have found quite a lot of evidence to prove the contrary of what the official word is.
Yeah, and this episode originally aired March 2nd of 1994, but talk about it like it is ever present, because there is a very popular podcast called The Accused. All of season 3 was dedicated to Dave Bock's mysterious death, and Dave Bock is, of course, the man who dies in the whistleblown episode. We will get there. Just wanted to give a shout out to The Accused, because that is where a lot of the information came from. In the last 4 days, I have binge listened to all 8 hours of it to bring you guys as much information as I could.
You know, I wasn't, they weren't on my radar at first, but when you mentioned that you were listening to them and that you were enjoying their information and their podcast, I gave it a listen. And I really enjoyed the production. I really enjoyed the completeness of what they do with their podcast. So something you're not going to hear too often on a lot of podcasts is us praising other people who are podcasters. but we do give credit where credit is due, and certainly they deserve the credit. And we'll put a link to their podcast in the show notes, of course.
Absolutely. But first, we start in Baltimore, Maryland in the spring of 1992. We have Cat Lady Sue Anderson, and she is moving from Baltimore to Modesto, California, and she is taking her five cats.
Five cats.
Ooh, in like the bed of a U-Haul truck. So she has five of them, but she's really close to Nova. Her brother's like tailing her caravan style because he's moving too. And, you know, they decide to pull over at a rest stop. And she rolls the windows down just enough, and Nova escapes.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who's ever had a cat knows that you really can't let them get out very often. It depends, though. Do you have any cats, Kim?
No.
No, you're a dog person.
Yeah, 100%.
But I, you know, we used to, when, growing up, we had a cat that was kind of like a neighborhood cat in a way. And everybody in the whole neighborhood would like feed this cat. And we, you know, and like my mother took the cat and had it neutered, and we'd get like shots. And the cat was just an outside cat, and it was the neighborhood cat. But I don't think that's a very common thing. I think
that's nice, though,
when cats indoors, they want to get out. And they don't come back. So when you do crack the window open, I'm thinking that the cat's going to be out, they're going to escape, and you're going to have issues, especially when you have five.
Yeah, and this rest stop is 200 miles before Modesto, so they are still a long way from home. And, you know, to be fair, Sue and her brother get out, and they're looking for her, and they're like, kitty, 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 you know, for like an hour.
Which cat was it that got out?
Nova.
No. Oh, right, right, you said that. I'm sorry.
No worries. So, you know, they had to pack up and leave Nova behind. But
Heartbreaking, you know, right? A little bit hard. I mean, four more, but I mean, you still, you've, you know, it's sad.
But still, no, totally. Mm-hmm. So, you, I guess they just had to move on, and Sue moves into her new house. She gets a job. Her coworker gave her this picture of a black cat, like almost like a coloring book page of a black cat, and she colors it in. And so every day she would come to work and stare at that picture of the black cat and just pray that Nova would find her way back.
It's almost like willing the cat in a way, like almost psychologically, like paranormally channeling to the cat, it seemed. I think that's what they were alluding to.
I think they were too, because they were saying that because she was in her work environment, she was almost like projecting her surroundings to Nova while staring at the picture.
Sorry, we're talking about Unsolved Mysteries, so we know the story isn't going to just end that she went and adopted another cat, right?
Right, because 1 year later in 1993, she saw a few stray cats outside of work, and this lady is a cat lady, so she feeds the stray cats. And this one comes up to her and she's like, oh my God, Nova? Nova, is that you? And she like picks up the cat. The cat, I guess, had like a same mole in their ear as Nova did and five distinguishing white hairs on her chest and the paws and everything. But I mean, I want to believe this so bad because A, it's a cool story, and B, it would make that lady's life complete. But isn't that possible? It's just another black cat.
I'm getting a little bit of a throwback to the movie Meet the Fockers, where they spray painted the cat's tail or something.
Oh man, yeah.
You know what? I want to accept that this is in fact the cat. And that's where we're left off with. We're left to believe that this is the cat. The cat returned, and that's that. Mm-hmm. With the days of microchips, of course, we all know that this doesn't happen so much, but it happens.
Well, speaking of it happening, again in 1992, we meet a new family. We meet John and Susan Riesgraf of Duluth, Minnesota.
Mother's Day.
It's Mother's Day. Them and their three kids and their two dogs arrive at a family cabin on the edge of Bearhead Lake State Park. Oh my God,
the picture you made is just, I don't know. I don't know why it made me laugh so much. It's like I'm in third grade all of a sudden. But
we'll post it on the Facebook page.
It's worth getting a giggle from, definitely.
I just got to show off my MS Paint skills. But they're basically 100 miles away from their home, and they brought their dog Lady, who's a collie, and Wolfka, a Belgian shepherd.
I love collies.
This was definitely like Lassie collie.
I don't know anything about a Belgian shepherd except that it looked like a beagle to me. Or maybe it didn't. I don't know that much about dogs. Believe it or not, more of a cat person. I just don't like the litter box.
Another way we're different.
Yes, but I have two dogs, so I mean...
That's true.
And no cats. So what kind of cat person has no cat?
Well, this family... this was a family cabin, so they've been there a lot before. And they used to just like let the dogs just run out and do their own damn thing. While the family's vacationing, and the dogs would have, like, the time of their lives. They'd get to run through the forest.
Isn't this what you do, though?
No.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I'm picturing, this is what people do. I don't have the kind of dogs that would come back, but I believe in my soul that people do have dogs like this, that will just kind of go out, and they come back, and everything's smart and good, but not my dogs. But I'm wrong.
Well, like, where we live now, obviously, it's all fenced in, but when we used to live in an apartment in Oregon, we used to take our dog out to the woods and just let her, like, run herself ragged.
Yeah.
So, but we would be, like, walking through the woods with her. We wouldn't just, like, drop her off, go back to our apartment, and then hope she found her way back.
You know? Right, right. Like, you know, some people just, they take the leash off, and it's like, you know, that just wouldn't work for my dogs.
Yeah, it depends on which dog, because I do have, like, a Nova-like or Lady-like connection with one of my dogs.
Yeah. Would they listen to you?
Well, yeah, but it's, like, a spiritual connection, which is a damn dog. But anyway, the family is like calling and calling for the dogs to come back and they never show up. So sadly, the next day there's like this huge forest fire and it's raging out of control and the family has to evacuate.
This is scary. This is the kind of thing where you, not only is there a fire that is threatening your own personal life and your family's life, but your dogs are now in it.
Yeah.
I would have just written them off, of course.
Oh, horrifying. Yes. So little 7-year-old Hannah doesn't want to leave without the dog. She's throwing a little temper tantrum, but the family's like, we got to go because this was a serious fire. It burned for over 3 days and consumed 9,000 acres.
Yeah. And did we ever learn if their cabin got burned?
No, it didn't get burned because he said like, oh yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I assumed it didn't, but they didn't say that they went back to the cabin. They went to the, back to the area.
Well, so they went back to Duluth where they live, but John, the dad, calls his father-in-law and asks him to go check on the cabin every once in a while to see if the dogs ended up showing back up to the cabin. So Hannah is like, I love Lady. I'm going to pray every night for Lady to come home because Wolfka is on his own. I don't know why she liked Lady so much, but
she even said that she had more of a connection with for Lady, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this little girl's praying to God every night for Lady to come home. And 13 days later, Lady shows up 15 miles away from the home.
But this is with a collar on, right? This was legitimately Lady.
Yeah, no, this was definitely Lady. And so she shows up in these people's yard. They call the Riesgraf family. And then they come pick up Lady. And it's like a big, happy reunion. There was an article written in the newspaper about it. And people had called up to say that where they saw Lady, like they had seen this well-groomed, lassie-looking dog walking along the railroad tracks, like all the way. And we get this fun little, like, Peter Rabbit, you know, map of all the locations where Lady stopped along the way. But yeah, in 13 days, they think that she had traveled 150 miles.
Well, but, I think, you know, it's a sweet story. It's a story we all love to see. If you go on YouTube, you find a whole bunch of things where people go away to the military, come home, and their dog hasn't seen them in like 2 or 3 years. And the dog doesn't even recognize them at first. And then all of a sudden, something clicks and the dog goes ape crap. So it's always a heartbreak. I mean, it's always sweet. It's always a tearjerker. So that's where this kind of falls into. Which
Except
brings up... Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
That Wolfka was never, ever found. They have no idea what happened to Wolfka, but, you know, I'm guessing like forest fire.
No. I didn't, they could, that really broke my heart, personally. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you felt that way. Then I was thinking that maybe Lady had a lot more of an adventure than we realized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who knows what happened, really.
Yeah, they said maybe Wolfka was adopted by another happy family, so I'm going to choose to believe that.
Yes, I'll take it.
But that does bring us to Intercept.
Yeah, sorry. So we're talking about, we're back on the whole concept of unidentified flying objects, or what people are tending to put into the category of identified flying objects. This falls into the category of a military jet. People are reporting seeing UFOs. They were UFOs because they're unidentified. The military said, no, 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 they're not jets. No, you're wrong. This is way before your time, but throughout the 80s, probably during the time when the space shuttle was so popular, stealth bombers and talk about these kind of modern aircrafts were just legend. Like, they didn't exist. Like, it was all mysterious black ops that kids would draw on the back of their notebooks because they didn't exist. You know, you had to, like, F-14s or F-15s, and that's it. And the stealth bomber was one of the first to kind of come out as we're legitimate. You know, it's a legitimate aircraft that's not only really fast, but it is it escapes from radar because it doesn't have any right angles. That's the technology. Radar can detect anything with right angles, and the stealth bomber doesn't have any.
That's cool.
I think that also has to do with the carbon fiber construction. Mm-hmm. So obviously, I don't know anything about aviation, but from what I understand, that's a fact.
Okay, cool.
But we're talking about a number of different experimental things that people are seeing. it's always fun to talk about these type of things, the things we see in the sky. Growing up around JFK Airport and LaGuardia, we're always seeing things in the sky, especially nowadays with drones. And it's very difficult to determine if something is legitimately foreign. And I'm going to guess most of it is not foreign.
Yeah, but it's so interesting because of how much the FBI was denying.
Yes.
No, this is not that. This is not that. But what I thought was really cool is this guy, Stephen Douglas, who we meet. He's a journalist, aviation enthusiast. He runs a newsletter called Intercepts. Mm-hmm. And he went out with his father-in-law to Roswell. And that's where the military was doing like mock war games, which I had never seen before. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, those are, I mean, it's crazy. They're in the middle of nowhere and they're just doing all of their attacks and everything. It's really crazy to see that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So Stephen goes outside in 1992 and he sees what is called a donuts on a rope contrail. We'll post a picture of it because it's pretty hard to explain, but he sees this new thing and he sends it to the FBI and the FBI is like, huh, yeah, we don't know what that's about.
Yeah. And I know that they went to go videotape it and you had a hard time believing that their videotapes would die.
Well, the thing is that he went to go videotape this brand new thing when they're at the war games with him and his father-in-law.
Right.
They see this brand new thing and he's like, oh my God, I think that's like what's rumored to be called the Manta. It's like a wedge-shaped flying unit.
Yeah.
And it is silent. And I think that's what they call it. But then 7 seconds later, his batteries die. And yeah. He didn't bring a backup battery for these mock war games. Like, I don't know. I find it hard to believe that 7 seconds after he starts seeing something very cool, it just all dies.
Well, two things I just wanted to mention. So this is considered the TR-3A, which, of course, came out to be a real thing. It's the Black Triangle plane. And it, you know, there's a lot. Even nowadays, people have a hard time believing it's even real, even though it's been around for so long. Now, what have you ever heard of a thing called EMP?
No.
All right. EMP is a technology they use in war games. You've heard a lot of people having a fear of, we need to upgrade our electrical grid in the United States, probably, because we're going to be attacked. Well, EMP stands for electromagnetic pulse attack.
Okay.
Well, if you had an A. And what that is it's an electromagnetic energy that's put into the air. And what it does is it, if anything that's electronic is basically either attacked or it is overloaded. Huh. And this is something that they use in warfare for 25 years. You could take down an entire city with an EMP pulse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not uncommon to hear this happening. Now, I'm not saying that is what happened, but I would imagine that they would be able to drain any type of battery from somebody who's just a spectator getting some type of, you know, amateur footage. And they would just be able to prevent people from being able to spread stuff.
Okay, and interesting.
It could be very directed to. And, you know, it's the technology that the military has is so far ahead of us that EMP is probably something that they've been using since the 80s.
Yeah, and I'd imagine that they're not too keen on spectators videotaping their mock war games.
Yes, with a big camcorder, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure they probably shut that down. Well, I didn't know that. Good to know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it definitely is that, but also there is legend about the TR-3B, which I was talking about a little bit, which is another triangular plane. If you want to do a Google search, it's TR-3B, and it is supposedly built for off-world travel using gravitational technology that was retrieved from Roswell.
Wow.
I'm not saying it's true. I'm not saying it's false. I'm on the fence. I just know that there are photographs of crafts that are very strange, and the TO-3B is one of those things where there's a lot of information about it, and they did lie about the original one. So.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because we leave Unsolved Mysteries where the Air Force absolutely denies that there is such a thing called a Manta, because that's what the guy, Stephen Douglas, thinks that he videotaped was called the Manta.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, nope, no such thing. If there is a thing, it's not one of ours. And then it was like, update, just kidding. It was one of ours. You got us.
Yeah, It's very much interesting whenever they get kind of when they come clean with what they're talking about.
Yeah, it made me laugh out loud to see an update like immediately after they denied it that they admitted to it.
I love this kind of stuff, but it does scare me a little bit about the technology that exists. And we're talking about a show from, you know, well over 20 years ago. So who knows what they have now? They probably have iPods. And we just had just a few days ago the Tesla launch with SpaceX astronauts are currently in space. It's incredible where technology has brought us.
Definitely.
But it also takes us way back. And this is the second time we're covering this story.
Yeah, and this is just an update. So as with all updates, we're just going to kind of breeze past it. But we're going to be talking about the Shroud of Turin.
It's an update, but it's also there's really nothing that has happened between then and today.
Yeah, the only thing is, so if you don't know what the Shroud of Turin is, it is a cloth that people believe Jesus, like the actual Jesus Christ, was wrapped up in. It appears to have the imprint of a man's face on it with like a bleeding, crown of thorns.
Well, here's the thing. You know, it's funny because when I was watching this, I got into a conversation with my wife, two Jews talking about Jesus. And I was trying to explain to her what the Shroud of Turin is. And so I didn't really realize this. Maybe I realized it, but it didn't really kind of click that this shroud was supposedly imprinted because of the energy of God or Christ or whoever you believe during his re-erection, you know, that people celebrate Easter for. So it's almost like an imprint from the power of God. So I can understand how the symbolic gesture connected to that. I mean, the symbolic nature of an imprint of something that's the outcome of the power of God, if you want to really go that far. I don't know. It's a pretty big story. I just don't know why we have to believe that this particular piece of material was Christ's. That's all.
Now, the thing that makes it more Christ-like, if you want, and just a quick side note, two Jews talking about Jesus sounds like a podcast I would want to listen to.
Yeah.
But
Two Jews on Film is a YouTube channel, actually.
Oh, maybe that's what I'm
from. One guy, I forget his name, he recently passed away, but he was the producer of Faces of Death.
Oh, God. Okay, well, I don't want to watch that.
No. He's actually a really nice guy, so...
Well, just what makes it more Christ-like is the bleeding crown of thorns. There is an absence of brush marks on it, so it's supposedly not a painting. And when the image is analyzed by, this computer technology, which we'll post a GIF of on our Facebook page, it is three-dimensional. So it was, laid over someone's face. But I think the most compelling thing is the resurrection theory of that's what imprinted it on the cloth and the bleeding crown of thorns.
I love it. I love the story. But have you ever heard of EMPs? No, I'm kidding. No, so I love it. I think that it's a it's not a relic. I'm forgetting the word. It's an artifact that really connects to the world of Catholicism and Christianity. I think if this brings faith to people and it brings them comfort to think that this is the imprint of the son of their God, then go for it. I don't see any harm in that personally.
I totally agree. I know you and I have talked before about if it makes you feel more comforted and it adds to your faith, go for it. We are not trying to take that away from you, but we do have forensic anthropologist Dr. Emily Craig telling us how this might have been done as a way to be greedy.
Yeah, she's probably not so popular if she goes to church.
That's what I was thinking. But just a fun fact, she is actually featured on three different episodes of Unsolved Mysteries as a forensic anthropologist, which I think makes her a candidate for our Paul Renfro Award of Excellence of people appearing on Unsolved Mysteries.
We need to keep track of this. I'm making a note to keep track of it.
Okay.
No, but yeah, absolutely. That's Dr. Emily Craig, you know, badass doctor. She's willing to go against the popular opinion and say, look, this is the way it can be emulated. And I'm not going to say she doesn't know what she's talking about. I'm just saying that I'm just not really sure if you need to kind of rain on everyone's parade
I know, but, you know, she's...
When facts are facts.
That's it. It's hard to get out of a scientist's mindset. But what she does is that she takes dried paint pigments in a technique that she calls dust drawing, which has been around for thousands of years.
Which sounds kind of amazing and fun. Not fun, yeah. But amazing.
Yeah, so she takes it, and it basically is dust. Like, almost like it looks like she's painting with cinnamon or something. And she paints it onto a piece of paper, and she paints this face, and she applies more paint on the raised areas of the face. So, like, the cheeks, lips, forehead, nose, and she lays a piece of linen on top of that and rubs it on the paper to make a transfer.
Yeah.
So that way there are no brush marks left, and they analyze it by the same computer, and it is 3D because of the higher level of paint applied to the raised areas.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't seem so impossible to do what she's saying. It seems a little difficult. Maybe there's techniques. I mean, there are a number of artistic techniques that I think that are questionable throughout centuries and centuries that we've been around creating art. Possible, right? But I think after our next story, you might want to grab the Shroud of Turin and wrap it around yourself and cry in the corner.
Oh my god, no. I 100% agree. I just didn't see that coming. So again, a lot of this, we're talking about Whistleblown, we're talking about Dave Box, a lot of this came from the Accused podcast. So you're going to hear things that you heard differently or that you didn't hear on Unsolved Mysteries, but these people at Accused, they put in 1,000 hours of research. They built a replica furnace. Like, these people did their research. So we'll post a lot of pictures on Facebook, but if you want to check it out and if you want to go to see more pictures, go to accusedpodcast.com.
Oh, I was just looking for it, and it doesn't go right there. People who are listening, there it is. Accused, if you happen to be listening to our podcast, you're number 5 when I Google you. So you should get rid of your Wondery links and your Cincinnati wrote up an article like 3 years ago. You should be number 1.
They should be number 1.
SEO.
They did their stuff. So,
but yeah, it's a very, very well done, very well researched, and I can't recommend the podcast enough.
Absolutely. And this is season 3 that we're talking about. That's the Dave Box one. So we start in Fernald, Ohio. And the town's main employer is a company called the Feeds Material Production Center, but it's also called NLO, which is National Lead of Ohio. And it is owned by the Department of Energy. Now, it's not exactly clear that this is owned by the Department of Energy, because when you first have to start working here, you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement that you won't tell anybody what you do. And they kind of purposely mislead people, it seems, to thinking that it's a Purina dog food factory. They have those red and white checkerboard symbols like all over the place. And that is like the international sign of animal feed production. So it seems like they were purposely trying to mislead. But from 1953 to 1989... it was one of the only nuclear plants in the United States that processed high-grade uranium for use in nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and I just wanted to kind of throw in that the technique they're using is very, very common. They still use it to refine plutonium and uranium, and it's relatively safe. It's very hot.
Yeah, and so we get to meet this guy, Harry Easterling. Now, he was told when he's an employee there, and he was told that when he started, it was just a low-level radiation plant, really nothing to work about.
Right.
To worry about.
Run for the hills when you hear that.
Exactly. But, you know, in the fall of 1984, there was an accident which caused 200 tons of radioactive dust particles to escape into the atmosphere, which, by the way, went uncorrected for 3 months.
Now, one thing, and I don't know if you're going to know about this, I don't, is the word tons being used in two different ways. There's tons, which a ton is 2,000 pounds, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's tons, which is what we're talking about probably here, where it's spelled T-O-N-N-E-S, where we're talking about, like, you know, carbon footprint, and it comes up in that sense. I just don't know what the relation is between those two. It sounds to me, though, that either way, it's bad. Like, it sounds like it's a lot of pollution. I just don't know if they're equal or not.
I just Googled it, and yeah, they're the exact same thing. Oh. It's just an alternate spelling.
I hate when things are double fact.
No worries. Well, We get to meet, like, fan favorite DC Cole. He is everything you want your 80s guy talking to Unsolved Mysteries.
I want him now. This guy's awesome.
I do, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, he has since passed away. But
rest in peace.
He's kind of... He's a mulleted, turtlenecked, chip-tooth investigative reporter.
Yeah. He's the type of guy who, I'm going to get down and dirty, and I got this chip tooth from the research. That type of guy.
Exactly. Exactly. So he's actually the guy who contacted Unsolved Mysteries. This was his like huge cause. He wanted to bring NLO down because he grew up a mile from the plant. He says his mom died of cancer because of the uranium that was like leaking into the well water. And he says that everybody that he knew growing up was either dead or dying from this.
Aww. You know, I did want to just mention, if you don't mind, a documentary about here on Long Island. A lot of people know that Long Island is pretty much the hub of everything. We're the armpit of the planet, I think, sometimes. No offense to our Long Island listeners. I'm a Long Islander. So we, out in Suffolk County, which is about 100 miles, maybe 80 miles from where I live, there is a school called the Frank B. Long Elementary School. It's a really remarkable documentary on Prime, or you can probably find it anywhere, called Sick School. And it's about a school that is created next to a garbage dump. And in that dump are a lot of really terrible waste. There are waste waters and all types of terrible things. And statistically speaking, a number of the people who work at the school have passed away from different cancers. Children died from cancers. And this is like an ongoing thing. They're not going to even be removing this dump until 2025 or begin removing it until 2025. And that school, although thankfully it's closed today because of the pandemic, it will reopen probably in the fall. And it's a real shame that that is going on when people are literally getting sick and dying. And it's just, it's a real shame. So yeah, it's just called Sick School. It's, if you want to see something that is going to super depress you and then question why people on Long Island pay some of the highest taxes in the country, watch that.
That sounds right up my alley. Add to queue. Like, I will be watching that.
As if I had to give you more of a reason to not want to move to New York.
I know, right?
All right.
Well, a few months before the accident, which led to all of the dust, you know, being added to the air, June 1984, employee Dave Box disappears while he's on the job. His body was never found, but some of his personal effects were. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But he worked at NLO for 3 years. Now, he's almost exclusively described as an introvert, somebody who just kept to himself. And the official ruling is that no foul play was involved in his death.
Even so, today, is that what they agree to? Okay.
Yeah. So they, yeah.
But that's what they paid off for?
Exactly.
No, but, I'm just joking. Of course, nobody got paid off.
Yeah, this allegedly. But we are talking about representatives from the Department of Energy and the Hamilton County Sheriff's Administration refused to talk with Unsolved Mysteries. But Dave's family and friends are convinced he was murdered. When he first started working in 1981, he was hired as a pipe fitter at NLO. He had two young sons and a young daughter. He had divorced his wife, Carlin, in the 1970s. Now, Monday, June 18th, 1984, it's 11 p.m., and he's getting ready to work his graveyard shift. So he does a rideshare thing with the guy, Harry Easterling, that we met earlier on Unsolved Mysteries, and they would always meet in a local White Castle parking lot. And, you know, one would drive them both one day. The next one would drive them both the next day.
Now, White Castles are like 24 hours. So I'm wondering if White Castle would, you know, you could park your car there. And it's like nobody's going to bother it. Maybe that's why they chose that. And it was also probably central location to meet.
Yeah. And Dave's like, from what I would understand, Dave would get White Castle pretty often. He would like go bring it for lunch or whatever.
Grab a sack. You know, okay.
Exactly. So Dave gets into Harry's car on this day. They drove to work, you know, chit-chatted, small-talked. But Dave did mention that he got a brand new lunchbox and that he was planning a vacation to Florida with his kids. So he was looking future-oriented.
Yeah, which you pointed out, it's not something that is usually in line with somebody who is depressed. I mean, if you are depressed, you do these things to kind of snap yourself out of depression, maybe.
Yeah, but it's pretty common that suicidal people are usually not future oriented. Now, no. Suicide, of course, can be, I forget the word, but like a spur of the moment thing. But it's they're usually not like excited about future plans. And he did seem to just be all about his kids, from what I can understand.
Which is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's actually seemed, I mean, from what we gauge from Unsolved Mysteries, I don't know if you got a different set of facts. I have a feeling you did. But he seems like an okay guy. Like, it doesn't seem like he's this horrible, miserable person.
No, not at all. So
a little bit of a tattletale, but that's a whole different story.
Well, his main job was to inspect and maintain equipment in all of the plants. And I do think that he was a great guy, and he did have his issues. You know, he was an alcoholic. He was a dry alcoholic, but an alcoholic nonetheless.
What is a dry alcoholic? I don't know what that is.
It's basically an addict who is not currently using.
So he was in between using? Or is he just...
Well, it's like, you know, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic of thing. Like, you're never not an alcoholic. But you just, you're just not using at the moment. So you don't plan on using, but this is like
maybe he wasn't in any type of, I guess, official program, like AA or something.
Right. Okay. And it's actually the reason why him and his wife got divorced. And he was having episodes after, and it led to him being diagnosed as schizophrenic. So when he was in the thick of it with his wife, he did try to overdose on medication, taking 10 times the amount that he was supposed to have.
Yeah.
And he did end up in the hospital for a few days, but that was a few years ago. And he got this job, you know, he's settling into life. He just bought groceries. He saw his kids that morning. He's just heading to work. It's a normal Monday for him.
By the way, he got through his overdose. So if you're listening to this and you're depressed, think about this. All right, granted, this guy has a different outcome at the end of the story, but, you know, you don't need to, you know, it got better for this guy before it got worse. Yeah,
for sure. Reach out to us on the Facebook page. Like, we'd like to
pump the brakes. but you should reach out to professionals and people who actually.
Oh, yeah.
So I would just say, hey, cheer up. You know, I don't know if I would give the best advice, but I would do my best.
That's fair. I'm just trying to say,
I don't
want to
miss an
friends.
Email. That's all.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then never mind. But for Dave, his main job was to inspect and maintain the equipment in the plant. So he would casually kind of warn his coworkers to be careful around the dust, or say, oh, be careful, that one's kind of extra radioactive, because he knew the problems that were going on. He was basically like a fix-it guy around there.
Yeah.
Now, only the maintenance crew and security were on duty during the graveyard shift, because this was like a uranium plant and there was like armed security with a gun in a tower as you drove in.
Wow.
You had to give your ID when you went in. You had to give your ID when you left. Like, this place was locked down.
And it's uranium. I mean, we know what's going on here. You know, this is, I forget what it's called when it's like it's a third party basically creating this and selling it to the government.
Right. But it is owned by the Department of Energy. So because it was the graveyard shift, the production lines are shut down. And at midnight, now we're on Tuesday, June 19th, Box reported to the maintenance room for work, and he was told to report to Plant 8. Now, he unlocked his toolbox, left his keys with the lock attached in the toolbox. And he grabbed his tools and went on his merry little way. Now, at 4 a.m., Box and his supervisor, who we'll just call Supervisor Charlie, were seen in a parked pickup truck by another NLO employee called Melvin.
Mm.
Now, the pickup truck that they were in, it was a blue pickup truck, and it wasn't uncommon for them to be in it together, because that is how everybody got around from plant to plant. Like, this was a huge operation. So if you were needed in, say, plant 4, but you were in plant 8, you would hop in the pickup truck and go over there. They had multiple blue pickup trucks.
Yeah, if you look at camp, the actual map of the place, it's like a campus, really.
It's humongous. Yeah. So he just thought it was weird because they were parked there and the windows were rolled up. Now, there was no air conditioning. It was a warm
That June. Was my question. All right.
Yeah. It was a warm June, muggy night, so it was really weird that they would have their windows rolled up. And Melvin says they were talking seriously, but he couldn't hear enough to know if they were, like, arguing. So Supervisor Charlie, when the police come sniffing around later, interestingly, never told police that they were in the truck together. Supervisor Charlie at 4 a.m., him, Harry, the guy with the rideshare earlier, and our guy Dave, all had lunch together. Harry just said everything was normal, but Charlie said that Dave was just depressed, despondent, and trying to talk to him was like pulling teeth. But Harry, to this day, says no, he was just his regular self. So at 4:46 a.m., Harry and Dave clock in at Plant 4 after lunch. Plant 4 is where the time card, cha-chunk, you know, clock in thing.
Yeah.
This is the last time that Harry saw Dave. Harry saw Dave get into a blue pickup truck, and that's, like we said earlier, how the pipe fitters kind of traveled between plants. So at 5 a.m., witness Melvin from earlier ran into Dave. And he's like, hey, do you need any hand? You know, I'm around, whatever. And Dave's like, nah, it's cool. I got it. And he didn't see Dave walk into Plant 4 because it was really foggy out. But he heard the security gate open and close around Plant 4. So he thinks that Dave got into the building of his own accord. Okay. 5:15 a.m. This is the last time that Dave is seen alive. Supervisor Charlie says that he ran into Dave and they chatted for 10 minutes. Now, keep in mind, he's the same guy who said he was despondent, depressed, and wouldn't talk before.
Right, and all of a sudden you're having a conversation with the guy for 10 minutes. Like, what'd you
for
talk
10
about?
Minutes. Yeah. Yeah, and you're clocked in. Like, you know, you're not getting paid to just
I have a feeling this job is a lot of downtime, though.
There's a lot of shenanigans going on around this place.
You know, so, a lot of White Castle, a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and you're not far off with that. But Supervisor Charlie says that after their little chat, Dave walked off to Plant 8, and that's the last time that anybody ever saw Dave. So keep in mind, Supervisor Charlie is the last person to see Dave, and he says that himself.
Right. I mean, so, of course, whenever people say that, I think, well, how do you know?
Yeah, and, you know, you usually take a look at the person who last sees him alive, not unlike the Tammy Lynn Leppert case. Like, let's talk to the guy who last saw her.
Mm-hmm.
So Harry and Carpool Harry and Witness Melvin say that they both heard Supervisor Charlie calling for Dave on the radio around 6 a.m. And Melvin's like, oh, I haven't seen Dave, but, you know, I can do it if you want to. And he goes, no, I don't want you. I want Dave and I want Dave alone. So maybe kind of set up an alibi or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, so, the whole thing is very shady. Like, to call him and him alone is a very strange type of thing. There was definitely something going down that night.
Absolutely. So Supervisor Charlie also never told the police that he called Dave on the radio, even though Melvin and Harry both did. And the police never followed up. The police never interviewed Supervisor Charlie or never went in depth about Supervisor Charlie. So it's about 7 a.m.
Also, there no cameras in this place, right?
Surprisingly, right, with all of this security going on.
Because I'm thinking this is, all right, you're saying that the, who owned this, essentially, the form of the government?
Of Energy.
All right, so
National Lead of Ohio.
But these are not government employees. So this is an NGO, which is a non-governmental organization, which, you know, they get. It's a very shady thing, NGOs, you know, but it's essentially a third party that works for the government, you know. And I would just imagine, I have to imagine, that cameras did exist, and this is probably on. If it is owned by the government, then they wouldn't have to really go public with these cameras and show the evidence publicly.
So maybe there is, and they haven't told us about them, but it's weird that there wouldn't be cameras, A, with the amount of security that they had, and B, I heard a lot of people using the term like pinkos, you know?
Yeah.
And this is, we are in the height of
such
the
an
Cold
old
War.
Word.
I know, that's what makes me giggle, but we're in the height of the Cold War, and we're talking about nuclear weapons, so it was a big concern. You'd think that they would have cameras.
Yeah, you'd think that they wouldn't want the commies to get in there.
Yeah, the pinkos.
Oh,
so
geez.
At approximately 7 a.m., there was supposed to be a safety meeting in a conference room at Plant 4. And there was, but Dave wasn't there. So after the meeting, Harry returns, and he goes to his toolbox, and he notices that Dave's toolbox is still open. So he's like, I guess Dave's working overtime. So he made a few calls trying to find Dave, and he couldn't, because keep in mind, they drove there together. So Harry went to the security guard and told him that he was going to leave, but if the security guard saw Dave, tell him that they can meet up tomorrow at White Castle, and they'll carpool in again. So 7:30, Supervisor Charlie told police that he went into Plant 8 around 7:30 and saw that Dave had clocked out. Now, it was later discovered that Harry had actually clocked out Dave's time card for him. And it's just one of those things that buddies do for each other. You know, he didn't want him to have to walk all the way back to Plant 4.
Or did he, like, vanish and he's... Maybe he often vanished. Maybe I have a feeling there's a lot of downtime. Sometimes people head home early. Sometimes, probably, if there's no cameras, who's watching? And maybe it's like he legitimately thought, all right, you know what? I'll just clock him out. Because this happens pretty common.
Dave was what is, by all accounts, like a complete stickler for the rules. However, when they interviewed Harry and a couple other people later, they said that they thought that Dave might just be sleeping somewhere, like he fell asleep on the job.
A lot of downtime.
So I think that's why they kind of helped clock him out, too. But Harry had an appointment to go to that day, so he actually left to work, and he left a note for Dave saying that he would be back to get Dave around 9 a.m. So it's later discovered that there is this big furnace, okay? And it is just filled with molten salt. Mm-hmm. It is potassium chloride and sodium chloride. And the temperature is always at 1,350 degrees.
Because 24/7, they are basically refining uranium. And that's what the furnace is for. It's, you know, salt... The reason they use potassium chloride and sodium chloride together is it retains heat and it maintains the heat very, very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they would take the uranium ingots and dunk them in the molten salt. But they had little heaters in there to heat it and always keep it at 1350 degrees. So they find the like temperature log of it and they found that, quote, momentarily, it had dropped 28 degrees.
Yeah.
Now, Unsolved Mysteries says that this was just like a momentary blip, but this thing actually happened for 15 minutes.
Yeah, that doesn't... It's really just not the type of thing. Now, here's another thing. Whenever they have these furnaces going, it's not like a nuclear reactor. It doesn't just retain energy forever. It needs to have fuel added. You know, it's like you can't... And you would... constantly be adding probably at least once a week, maybe you'd be adding a certain amount that burned off.
Sure.
So, and they would also have skimmers to remove the waste and all of these type of things. And I'm going to imagine that if you have room temperature chemical and you put it into the furnace, it's going to make the temperature drop. So I'm not saying that it wasn't a body that made it drop, but what I'm saying is, it's probably not completely uncommon, but they would say, all right, well, 6 a.m. is when we added to the fuel.
Right.
That accounts for the drop.
And
I would do it at the same time, of course.
Yes, but I think a compounded thing that happens at the same time that raises some red flags about that temperature dip is a furnace operator in Plant 6 has notified his supervisor that there is, quote, a strange sticky residue in his furnace.
This is where the episode gets like, wait, what did he just say? It's a strange smell, a sticky residue, and something that looks like, you say it.
A black brown crust on top. Oh, and something that looks like a leg.
Which you've dug up that it might be an embellishment.
I think that was kind of for the magic of television. From what I could understand, there was little bone fragments and stuff in there, but there was no like human leg just floating in there, which is how they made it.
I picture like, you know, a Doc Martin boot floating on the top or something.
Yeah, like I pictured like a leg in coveralls, you know, just like bloop, bloop, you know.
What
in
a terrible way to die. It's not the even worst. Hot enough to kill you like instantaneously.
Truly, if he was conscious when he went in there, absolute hellish nightmare, the worst way to die.
And you actually likened it to a 1990s movie, which you showed me, and I'm going to say that you're spot on in the visual.
Okay, so no disrespect to Dave or his family, but I know that you guys will know what I'm talking about. There is a disturbing scene in Who Framed Roger Rabbit where, what's his name, Christopher Lloyd, dips these little cartoon shoes into a vat of acid, and that's all I could picture. I felt so bad for Dave. Oh, my God, this is just horrifying.
Yeah.
It's so just, the suit, yeah.
The only thing that we can hope for is that if this is the scenario, that they at least killed him first.
Oh, I hope he was dead before he went in there. At least unconscious, but dead would be best case scenario, just for his sake, you know, for quickness of death's sake. Yeah. So the supervisor just told the worker to go ahead and just stir that crust back in and go back to work. Like, enough fooling around.
That just gives me the chills. Like, stir the crust back in. It just doesn't feel right to me.
It's horrifying. So at 9:20 a.m., Harry seems to be a really good friend. He comes back from his appointment, and he's still looking around for Dave, but nobody's seen him. So he gives up waiting at 10:45 a.m., and he leaves a note that just says, Dave, waited till 10:45, finally went home. Sorry, Harry. So this just isn't sleeping right. You know, he went to bed, I'm sure, but it's not sitting right with him. So all through the day on Tuesday, Harry is calling Dave at home, and he never gets an answer. So it's 11 o'clock, still Tuesday night, time for his next day's shift. Harry arrives at White Castle to meet Dave, and Dave's car is in the parking lot. So Harry tries to get into Dave's car, but it's locked. So he's like, he must have been grabbing those White Castle burgers. So he leans up against the car, and the car is like ice cold. So he's like, okay, this car has not been used. Something is wrong. He got to work, and he reported Dave missing to the security guard. So a security guard comes over and cuts the lock off Dave's work locker.
Which I think is just kind of like, hey, he's been gone for like 12 hours, you know?
Yeah, it was. It does seem like a bit of an overreach, but the fact that nobody had seen him is pretty
concerning. It could be their policy, too.
Yeah, and scarily, when they open up the locker, they find that the clothes Dave was wearing yesterday are still in there untouched.
Yeah, which of course, it's just, I mean, I would imagine also that there would be other clothes and everything, you know, but yeah, I mean, that's definitely strange. It's definitely showing that he hasn't been back and forth, and I guess he comes to work and changes out of the clothes. Was that the,
You're not allowed. Okay. You have to come to work, strip down completely naked, take a shower, put your coveralls on, go to work, come back, strip down, take another shower, and then put your other clothes on.
Gotcha.
So there was no chance of contaminants. So they're looking and looking for Dave. Nobody sees him. They don't notify his family until Wednesday that he is missing. Now, on Thursday, Dave's ex-wife and the mother of his kids tries contacting the plant, but they won't give her any information whatsoever. So they launch an internal investigation, and during the investigation, a worker found a bone fragment on the lip of that furnace. So they decide to call the sheriff's department in. And the furnace was shut down, and after 3 days, the liquid in the furnace was finally cool enough to handle the molten salt. So it basically solidified. Everything was rock solid, and they had to get in there with, like, jackhammers to loosen it all up. So they, for some reason, let the employees sift through all the material for evidence. And I know it's radioactive, but I really feel like that should be the sheriff doing that.
I just think that they should have an entire forensic team really going through this. I mean, it's like, you know, what's to say somebody's not going to find something and cover it up?
Absolutely, especially in this type of scenario. So they're digging through all the molten salt. They find keys. Harry swears that the keys that were found were still in the toolbox the next night at 11 a.m. on Tuesday night when he checked in, but the keys were found in there. Almost the implication is that somebody tried to cover it up and throw them in with Dave. So Harry's basically saying Supervisor Charlie took the keys out, locked the lock, relocked the toolbox, tossed them in. Now, what they also find in this big vat of salt is a steel toe from a boot, eyeglasses frame, Dave wore glasses, bits of metal from a walkie-talkie, and here's the crazy part, this weird loop-de-loop wire and several pieces of bone.
Now, when I heard about the loop-de-loop wire, maybe you thought the same thing, and they choked him to death. That's what I was thinking.
Well, they quickly show us a reenactment of somebody like wrapping the wire around his feet. So there's two of the loop-de-loops and then one around this like bridge crane from the ceiling and using that to kind of like dunk him into the vat.
And I did point out, I don't know if you agree with this, but, you know, if he's wearing coveralls or like where's the other steel-toed boot, you know, the steel-toe part? You know, if he had buttons or buckles that might have been on his outfit, it's steel. It's not going to melt. It will literally float to the top. And I did make I made a little bit of a joke, but not really. I'm going to imagine that a lot of crap was thrown into this furnace at times. Like, maybe they threw their garbage in there all the time. Because even though it should be hard, like, when it cools off, it's not like a rock. It's salt. You know, you can use a pickaxe.
Yeah, but... And I'm going half on the police information and half on the reenactment. Because in the reenactment, you see these guys moving basically rocks. And they are jackhammering through it. But you are actually 100% right that they did throw stuff in there from time to time.
But
they
if it was that case, like say this is like a furnace that's been running for 10 years. And, you know, there's no reason to empty it and refill. You just keep adding. Mm-hmm. I mean, over the course of a decade, throwing garbage in there, it's burning together. You have a lot of things that aren't salt anymore. And when it solidifies, of course, all that carbon is going to turn into like concrete.
Exactly. Exactly. And they would often throw apples in there because of the water content of apples. I guess it would go like boom, like a big shotgun blast, they said. And all the managers would come scrambling out and they would laugh and laugh and laugh because it's the Hades and all these safety standards are just
I would
so
hate
crazy.
These people. That would scare the crap out of me.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the point, and it's the overnight shift, guys. But yeah, trust me when I tell you that was like their favorite thing to do was throw apples in there.
Not eggs. Yeah, you know, you can picture like throwing an egg, it would explode and then float to the top.
Yeah, probably. They only talked about apples on The Accused. But an explanation for the wire, if we're going to say maybe it wasn't to dunk him into the, you know, vat, was that an employee told the police that he was previously experimenting with a new way to dunk the uranium ingots in, and he would put the ingots through two of them and then hold on to the other one, and I guess it would kind of let him get a little further away.
Yeah.
Or like loop it through something, but that's just what the employee said.
And they're saying that it possibly dropped in there, but I don't buy that because these vats have sieves, you know, and they would they would raise the platform and because, you know, people do drop things that you would need back that would not melt in there that could contaminate everything. You'd be able to, you'd legally, not legally, but health-wise, you'd have to remove it. And there are definitely like type, you know, like in a fryer basket type of situation.
Yeah. I just, from the vibe I got from the whistle being needing to be blown, from the podcast, from everything, these people did not give a crap about safety. Like, they just didn't care.
Yeah, no, and that's probably the case.
Well, we get to meet Dave Day, and he's a former NLO employee and union leader, and he says that he thinks Dave Box was murdered. So we go back to crazy DC Cole, who I love. I call him crazy.
When he came back on the screen, I was like, oh, he's back.
Yeah. Well, he's like the reason for the season. He's the one who contacted Unsolved Mysteries, but he says that Plant 8 had four times the amount of radioactive contaminants that had released them into the environment than any other plant.
Terrible.
And he posits that it is a whistleblower type situation. Dave was a stickler for the rules. He knew stuff wasn't going right into the factory. And so that's why he was killed to cover it up.
Now, you had also mentioned that he actually blew the whistle on other people who were actually out on for disciplinary reasons while this was going on.
There was one guy named Ernie who Dave had reported to his supervisor for sleeping on the job because there was a lot of people sleeping on the job in those days.
Downtime.
And he reported him for sleeping on the job and he was suspended for 2 weeks. It just so happens that during these 2 weeks is when Dave disappears. So there are many. Oh my God. There's so many facts about this, but in 1989, the NLO was actually shut down because of this like huge leak. It was crazy. This is the saddest part. Dave's remains are too toxic to be buried underground. So they put him in like a big radioactive drum, put all his bones and stuff in it, sealed it shut, and he has to stay at the closed down site of NLO.
Now, do you think that there are a lot of remains of him, or do you think that they're really, really enough for a shoebox?
I
don't mean to be so graphic. It's just I'm hoping that's only like a shoebox just because it really is. It's horrifying. It's a very tragic tale. I mean, they can't even cremate him.
No, he is so radioactive. They can't even test it to see if they're human bones.
Send it to space or something. I don't know. It seems very tragic. And
if you were murdered there, Yeah. Oh, definitely. And if you were murdered, if he was murdered, to have your body have to stay at the site that you were murdered at for all eternity, or at this company that you were supposedly trying to bring down, like, that is just a fate worse than death. That's horrible.
What is on that location now?
It is actually a nature preserve. They did like an overcorrect of like, oops, sorry about poisoning all your well water. Like, here's some trees. So they but it's still radioactive. Exactly. Look at that deer with three heads. Like, it's still radioactive.
Yeah.
But it is, we'll post pictures of it. It's beautiful now, but I wouldn't go visit without like a proper hazmat suit on. So we have three main theories. Now, the first theory is that he was murdered, and this is probably the most likely scenario if you ask me. So there was a lid on the furnace. That's the whole reason why they had a bridge crane, was to lift this lid because it was that heavy. So if Dave killed himself, which is what the police say, he would have had to have taken the lid off, put himself inside, and then put the lid back on while he's already in the vat. It's impossible. There was a small opening that wasn't covered by the lid, but because on the Accused podcast, they built a replica. Like, he wasn't able to fit in without wiggling himself, moving all around. And, you said, just the worst way to commit suicide. So it seems like maybe, you know, Supervisor Charlie deserves a second look. They were last arguing in the truck. He claims he's the last one to see him alive, and he's asking for him on the radio.
So I think our consensus, I mean, at least my point of view, is that this was, in fact, a murder, because it's kind of like these suicides that come up where it's two shots to the back of the head type of situation. Or you, the person who, like, drowned in their hot tub and the top was put on.
Exactly.
No, it's just not possible.
And there's a couple other people that were angry at Dave Fox. Like we said, that guy that he got fired for sleeping on the job, he's a suspect. And there was apparently a ton of drug activity, like coke, cane, going around like crazy. And keep in mind, these are guys that are working overnight.
A lot of downtime.
Yeah, a lot of downtime.
Maybe a lot of ways to make money, too.
Yeah, exactly. And it seems like it was rampant there. And a lot of former employees were like, oh, yeah, the drugs were all over the place. And Dave did not mess with drugs. Keep in mind, he was in recovery. I guess he just didn't go for people around these super dangerous situations being like coked out of their minds. So it's possible that he stumbled upon something he wasn't supposed to see. Now, another theory that is creepy as hell is posited by DC Cole. DC Cole has a book. I need to take a deep breath here. The title is so long.
It is the best title ever recorded. And I'm, like I said, I'm going to guess that this is self-published, because I don't, coming from publishing, I don't know if I would, unless it's a medical book, the title's not going to be this long.
No, it's a three ring binder just filled with paperwork. So this is called Box Conspiracy, The Truth Behind the Mysterious Disappearance in 1984 of Fernald Nuclear Plant Worker Dave Box has remained a deep, dark, and even deadly U.S. government secret. Until now.
Say it three times fast. No.
Ooh, I can hardly say it one time fast, but
it's a tongue twister. But, you know, it is somebody who really wants to get the word out, obviously.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
He was the main cause. He was like the main force trying to find an answer for this. So he, in his book and in the Accused podcasts, the government admitted to stealing body parts of deceased Fernald employees to secretly test them for uranium poisoning to see if their current workers were being poisoned. But they did this so on the down low. And DC posits that in his book, this is what Dave found out about and why he was murdered.
Wow. Now, this is big. I mean, that is a very, it's extremely horrifying. It's also something that I'm really genuinely surprised that they didn't say you have to sign this release form so that if you do pass away, or even when you do pass away, we get an organ.
Well, if you want to know something horrifying, the person who found it out was the widow of one of the guys who worked there. She said that at the funeral, they had to put a pillow under his shirt because his chest was so concave because of all the organs that they took out without her permission.
Oh, my God.
It's horrifying. So basically, there's another theory. I know we're running short on time, but there's another theory that he faked his death, which, I mean, there's nothing to that. But there is a suicide theory. Keep in mind, he has a former suicide attempt. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 1976. He was an alcoholic, and he always kind of felt like he wasn't good enough for his parents. But basically, if he was lowered in to the vat, and keep in mind, they couldn't have used the crane because the crane would have had to have had the lid on it. If he was lowered into it, they're basically saying the water in his body would have displaced some of the molten salt, and it would have burned whoever had lowered him in there.
Now, all right, so my question about this, although I went in a different way and I was like, well, it's not really the water, it's whatever's in there, right? So you pop. I mean, it's disgusting to say, but you pop, and if you do pop, I'm going to guess you pop and your pieces go everywhere. Right?
Mm-hmm. I would say.
Is that the way that it would, like, they would throw an apple in? Now, would the apple explode immediately?
Yeah, the water molecules apparently would get so hot so fast that it would just, like we were talking about earlier, like, boom,
like a popcorn,
like a second
type.
You threw it in. Mm. Yes, exactly.
So let's just say a body would take, you know, maybe 15 seconds or something, maybe right away. It's horrifying. And I would imagine there would be DNA everywhere, if that was the case.
No, I would too. I would too. Even if he were to lower himself in, wiggle himself in, whatever, you'd think around the lip of it, like the workers would have to climb a ladder, stand on the lip of this, and then dip it into the furnace below.
And what kind of sadist does this? I mean, what kind of person hates themselves so much to do this to themselves?
I mean, I can't rule it out 100% because we have talked about like self-immolation and self-immolation, all this kind of horrifying suicide ways that you're like, oh, why would you do that to yourself? But I can't get inside anybody's mind, sure. Especially if they're thinking
irrationally, of course. You
exactly.
know, it's I'm not going to claim to know what was going on in this person's head, but I'm really hoping that we're wrong on the suicide.
Yeah.
And I do genuinely wish and hope and pray that he was not alive when he ended up in there. Because the bottom line, at the end of the day, he ended up in there.
Oh, yeah, he did.
One way or the other.
So basically, I could not agree with you more. The only thing I hope for him and for his family is that he was dead or unconscious when he got lowered in there, because that is just the worst thing I can think of. But my final takeaway from the Accused podcast is that the government for sure lied to people who lived around the area and the employees about the amount of radiation that was coming from it. They purposely misled people into thinking that it was a dog food factory. And it appears that they covered up a lot of deaths from there. There was other deaths at this company. There was a ton of people dying who worked at the company, who live around the company afterwards from cancer. So there's a lot of shady stuff going on, but I cannot recommend the Accused podcast enough. Trust me when I tell you guys, this is the tip of the iceberg to keep this episode around an hour, but there is so much great information in the Accused podcast, and there will be a link in the episode notes.
I remember all week you were saying, I'm going to go back to listen. I can't wait to go listen. And you just seem really excited about it. And I think that's what's great about some podcasts is that you can go and you can listen. And when you have so many pieces of information like this, there's not that many podcasts out there, in my opinion, that I can listen to like that. And you walk away and you're like, wow, I really feel like I not only learned something, but I feel like I experienced something. And I think that they really hit the nail on the head with it. I would say that their podcast is right up there with ours.
Totally. So,
I think all in all, it's a worthy podcast. It's definitely, if you like this podcast, you'll like theirs. Definitely.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. It's like a serial podcast. They have a different one each season, a different like mysterious death. So you asked me earlier about the police. They are still considering it a suicide. Now, Accused to Podcast says that the police are reopening the case, but I read what they said the police told them exactly. And they told them, we are open to reopening the case. I think that was kind of a cover their butts move. Let's get these pesky reporters out of here. Like, we'll just always say it's a possibility if we get enough info, but it's not definitive.
Wow. Well, I think that this is one of those cases that deserves the kind of cult following that it seems to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so haunting. I can only imagine being a child seeing that image of him being lowered down. And don't you worry, there will be a GIF of that made and put on our Facebook page.
Now, because you have really the amazing memory, especially of the two of us, we did bring up the theory several episodes ago about disposing of a body in a glass factory in Corning.
Yes, Dale Kerstetter.
And I just have to look at the comparison here. Yeah, you totally knew it like that. That's amazing. That's why that's why I think that our podcast is right up there with
Accused.
Was Accused, yes. So, no, but when we're comparing these two things, you know, one is molten glass, which is pure. It has to be clear. It has to have no artifacts, you know, and that's why, you know, certain crystal is so expensive and, you know, the processes mm-hmm. are so clean. Versus uranium purification, which is essentially salt and White Castle boxes.
Exactly. Yeah. And old apple cores.
But you see, like, I think I looked into it with the glass thing, if you could dispose of a body, and all they were doing is really finding that it creates a thing called a glass coffin.
Mm.
And that's another story for the future, but it's something that I'm looking into. Hopefully I can find some remnants of it on Unsolved Mysteries. But there's this rumor of in the early 1900s here on Long Island in the Glen Cove area, somebody encasing their daughter after she had passed away, a father who loved her so much, encasing her in a glass coffin. I never understood it, but I think that's what he did, is had her preserved in glass.
Whew.
So I'm looking into that, and if anybody has information on that. But and the rumor is it was out in the forest. So I'll tell you off air, but
okay.
If I find out anything that's like that, but it's just interesting. Yeah. With the molten glass versus the salt thing, you would always get this carbon to raise to the top, and you would have evidence of foul play or something being added that you really can't have in there. Only, I mean, I guess glass is far less forgiving than salt.
Yeah.
Just, it's crazy. The whole thing is very, very scary. It's very, because if anything, these plants have only gotten bigger nowadays
mm-hmm.
and more prevalent. So hopefully there are OSHA safety measures in place for these people who are putting their lives at risk to make a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
But Kim, I can't thank you enough for all the research you did in this episode and every episode.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. I love to do these shows with you.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.